It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll learn how to cook with beans, grains, seeds, and legumes for this week's edition of Food Friday. First, should members of Congress be allowed to trade individual stocks while they're in office? Right now, they can. Some lawmakers on both sides of the aisle want to make that illegal. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is one of them. She posted on Instagram last month, quote, "Because we have access to sensitive information and upcoming policy, I do not believe members of Congress should hold trade individual stock, and I choose not to hold any so I can remain impartial about policymaking." House Speaker Nancy Pelosi disagrees. Here's what she said when asked about it before the holidays.
Because this is a free market and people, we are a free market economy, they should be able to participate in that.
There is a law called the Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge, or STOCK Act. It says members of Congress are forbidden from using non-public info to make trades, and it requires regular reporting of stock transactions. Pelosi said lawmakers do need to follow that. According to our guest, most of them are, but some blur the lines a little, and a few have some explaining to do. For the last 5 months, he and his colleagues have been investigating the personal finances of every sitting federal lawmaker and their top staffers. They've found many conflicts of interest related to COVID-19 info, U.S. defense policy, environmental issues, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should members of Congress be allowed to buy and sell individual stocks while in office? Why or why not? What questions do you have about this STOCK Act? What's acceptable and what's not? What do you want to see happen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dave Leventhal is the Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Business Insider. His reporting on the finances of members of Congress is part of Insider's project called Conflicted Congress. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure. Good to be with you.
You and your colleagues covered a lot of ground over the last 5 months or so. What were some of the basic questions you set out to answer here?
So going back to 2020, there had been a couple of incidents, a couple of episodes where lawmakers ran crosswise into the law that you just described, the Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act of 2012. And what was happening was in the early days of the pandemic, there were questions about whether they were using information that they came upon by virtue of them being members of Congress and acting on that information in a way that helped them basically game the market, make trades, stock purchases, stock sales, that would be beneficial to them personally. So flash forward about a year, we had begun to see sort of a critical mass of situations where lawmakers were just either not following this law or making trades that seemed to be, if not in violation of it straight up, in violation of the spirit of the law. And we found also too that a number just weren't complying with the law. And also, you know, in having to disclose the activity that they were by law, by their own passage of this law that they had to do, that they weren't living up to that. So that led to us wanting to really ask the question, hey, is there more going on here? And in prompting us to dig deeper.
I want to look at both halves of the STOCK Act. So one part is, as you said, members of Congress, according to this law, aren't supposed to use inside information they might get from, say, a committee hearing or something like that to influence their stock sales or purchases. How is that enforced? It seems like it might instantly have a lot of gray area there.
Well, first of all, it is very difficult to prove. There's an incredibly high standard, a very high bar for investigators being able to say Senator so-and-so or Representative so-and-so actually did engage in insider trading in a way that is illegal by federal law. And in fact, nobody has been criminally convicted of doing so under the STOCK Act since that was passed about a decade ago. The only exception would be Chris Collins, a former House member from upstate New York, who he engaged in related activity, but ultimately wasn't charged under the STOCK Act, although he was convicted in stock-related shenanigans, if you will, that landed him in federal prison, although he was pardoned in December of 2020 by then-President Donald Trump. So that's the one side of the coin. The other side of the coin, too, is, you know, even if you are able to get beyond just the insider trading aspect of all of this. There's the disclosure aspect of all of this. And the Stock Act, as you mentioned earlier, does not prohibit members of Congress from trading individual stocks. That was something that was initially proposed. It was rejected by Congress as part of the final bill. And in the thought then was that, hey, if lawmakers are going to, in a very timely fashion, disclose the nature of their personal stock trades, then that's going to be good enough to defend against conflicts of interest. That's all fine and good, but the Stock Act's disclosure provisions are only as good as the compliance with those provisions. And we found in our reporting 52 lawmakers over the course of 2021 who did not comply with the Stock Act's disclosure provisions. Sometimes in a fairly minor way, it might be a stock trade or two. They would have been late. They have between 30 and 45 days to disclose their activity, and perhaps they were a week or two late. Others were months or even years late, and the total amount dollar-wise of their assets that they were trading, the stocks that they were buying and selling, sometimes numbered into the millions, and even in a couple of cases, tens of millions of dollars. And none of this was being disclosed in the time frame that was set forth by the Stock Act, which is Congress's own rules of the road for itself.
If I'm a member of Congress, and I'm not, but if I buy and sell some stocks, I don't disclose these things, these sales, say, by the deadline, big amounts of money in those, what happens to me?
Not much. Almost at worst for you as a member of Congress would get a $200 fine. And that would be the case whether you were a couple days late or months late. It would also be the case if you had just traded a few hundred dollars of stocks or a few million dollars worth of stocks. So the carrot in the stick are really almost non-existent here. There's very little that is incentivizing people to follow the law. And if you don't follow the law, there's very little that is in the way of punishing you for that transgression.
Talking to Dave Leventhal with Business Insider, part of a big investigation into Congress and financial conflicts of interest, often related to stock sales and purchases. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it should be illegal for members of Congress to buy and sell individual stocks? What kind of accountability, what kind of transparency do you want to see when it comes to members of Congress and their financial investments and assets? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Dave, you didn't just look at the Stock Act, you and your colleagues in this report. You also looked at potential conflicts of interest where, say, I'm on a key committee working on an issue and I own stocks in a business directly related to that issue. What kind of things did you find there?
Well, first of all, we found more than a dozen lawmakers who are tasked with shaping U.S. defense policy because they sit on either the House or the Senate Armed Services Committee. They are people who also were actively investing in military contractors, companies such as Lockheed Martin or Northrop Grumman, those who make bullets and bombs and weapons systems. Many people that we talked to said this is a gross conflict of interest, and they should not be doing that, although it is perfectly legal for them to do so. We found a number of very environmentally minded Democrats who are rated very highly by organizations such as, say, the League of Conservation Voters, who in their speeches and their public statements are very environmentally minded, but they were also investing, we found, in fossil fuel companies or power companies that have fossil fuels as a significant amount in their portfolio of energy generation power plants. The list goes on and on. I think one that affects everyone in a major way is that we found almost 75 lawmakers who had stock holdings right as the pandemic was taking place in the year 2020, who invested in Moderna and Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer, the three big COVID vaccine producers here in the United States, or had investments in companies that we were able to identify as being very pandemic sensitive, companies that make tests for COVID, or PPE, personal protective equipment, that was, of course, being used and still is being used in the midst of the pandemic. So that, too, raised a major issue in the minds of many of the folks that we talked to for this article as to whether that type of activity should be legal, and whether lawmakers should be doing that or not be doing that while they're members of Congress.
And we've seen some lawmakers claim, hey, there's COVID news is in the newspaper. I, as an investor, I could have gotten this information publicly. Are there indications at all that they may have gotten some advance warning before the public got it that might have influenced their buying or selling of stock?
So what we know is, in general, members of Congress receive much more secretive or information that would be out of the public eye than you or me or any general American. It's impossible to know what they're saying in those meetings, or what they're hearing, or what they're reading when they get secretive information or classified information. So unless you're in that room, it's almost impossible to tell. And therein lies really the rub here. You have people such as Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, who say, look, you know, we can, as lawmakers, read the news as well as anyone else. We're not doing anything that is illegal. This is a free market economy, and lawmakers should be able to participate in it as well as anyone. The other side to that is, well, lawmakers are elected to represent the people. They are not elected to represent their own personal financial interests. So whether it is a perceived conflict or an actual conflict, lawmakers should hold themselves to a higher standard, so this theory goes, and they should effectively abstain from engaging in this, or Congress, the argument goes, should ban lawmakers, ban itself from making these types of trade, so that there is no issue in the first place.
We're looking at potential financial conflicts of interest involving members of Congress and their staff. Dave Leventhal is our guest, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Business Insider, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. There have been efforts to make it illegal for lawmakers to buy and sell individual stocks while they're in office. They fell short. They still can do those things. Do you think that's a good idea? Would you like to see things change? What would you like to see done to avoid financial conflicts in Congress? What questions do you have about existing laws like the Stock Act and other measures to prevent conflicts of interest? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about some new reporting on financial conflicts of interest for members of Congress. Business Insider spent months digging through financial disclosure reports for each sitting federal lawmaker and some of their top staffers. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's appropriate for members of Congress to buy and sell individual stocks? Do you worry about it raising ethical questions, conflict of interest questions? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dave Leventhal stays with us, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Business Insider. He's been working on Insider's Conflicted Congress Project. Let's go to your calls now. Louie is with us in Oconto. Louie, hi.
Yeah, I believe they should have to put their individual stocks in a blind trust and have it managed by an outside interest. Doctors have to do that. They used to have drug companies come in and wine and dine them, and that's kind of went out the wayside because there was a conflict there. I believe there's a conflict. There probably was a conflict in stopping Line 3. If you had an interest in that oil company, you really wouldn't want to stop it, even though you know it might be the best for the country.
Louis, thanks a lot for the call, Louis, referring to a pipeline there. But the blind trust idea, Dave, what kind of options are there out there for a member of Congress?
Lawmakers right now can put their assets into what's called a qualified blind trust. And a qualified blind trust is something that Congress itself has said is sort of the highest defense against having a perceived or an actual conflict. It would be money that is not only put into an account that is governed by an independent trustee. So therefore, the lawmaker has not only an arm's length relationship, but really no relationship with his or her own money, cannot control it. But also, too, the trust documents are published publicly. Anyone can read them. And it's approved, the trust, by either the House or the Senate Ethics Committee, depending on which House the member is in. So although that is an option, the answer to the question of, well, how many people have in Congress have availed themselves to creating a qualified blind trust? We ran the numbers, we checked every member of Congress and only found about a dozen who have gone ahead and created such a trust. It is expensive to do so, and it takes some time, but most members of Congress just simply don't choose to go that route at this point.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Wendy joins us now in Neenah. Wendy, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I worked for many years before retiring back in Wisconsin as an ethics counsel for a federal agency in Washington, D.C. And obviously what I was working with were the ethics laws that apply to executive branch employees, which are a little bit tighter than what currently applies to Congress, although the Stock Act also applies to members of the executive branch. It seems to me that we want to hold our elected representatives just as responsible, if not more, since they're creating the laws, as we hold members of the executive branch who are employees of the government. I've seen a lot of problems over the years, especially under the criminal conflict of interest statute in the executive branch, but there are certainly are situations in the legislative branch that mirror what I saw in the executive branch and were not handled in anywhere near the same fashion.
Wendy, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. I appreciate it. Dave, are there efforts to raise the standards for members of Congress? I guess that would have to be a law, though, passed by Congress.
It would be. And Wendy's absolutely correct that the executive branch rules and regulations, rules of the road, are different than in the legislative branch in Congress. And in many cases, they are more stringent on the executive side than they are on the legislative side. Congress is its own cop on the beat. Congress is its own referee. And Congress alone is in the position to strengthen these rules if it chooses to do so. There are a couple of different bills that at this very moment are pending in Congress. They're mired in committee. They have not been debated in any full-throated type of fashion on the House or the Senate floor and seem to be going nowhere fast, at least at this point. But there are at least a handful of members of Congress who are making this an issue, not the least of which is Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, who's been very outspoken in her belief that that the rules should change. But this is not a Democratic and or Republican type of an issue. I mean, this is a truly bipartisan phenomenon that we found, both in terms of the members of Congress who do choose to trade individual stocks. Democrats and Republicans do it almost straight down the middle. And also those who have violated the Stock Act's disclosure provisions. Democrats and Republicans have done it almost straight down the middle as well. So in a way, there's a lack of incentive for a bipartisan solution in that you have both Democrats and Republicans who perhaps understandably, perhaps not, are concerned that if they do something that is going to restrict their activity or if they do something that could really hurt the other side, that it's going to come back to bite them in the end. So in a way, the choice here is for Congress to do nothing as to do something that is going to be strong and decisive when it comes to individual stock trades among members.
Talking to Dave Leventhal from Business Insider about potential conflicts of interest facing members of Congress. Dave, you went lawmaker by lawmaker and state by state with a number of criteria. What did you find in the Wisconsin delegation?
So we ranked every member as part of conflicted Congress on a set of standard metrics across the board with every member. And Wisconsin's delegation did pretty darn well, actually, by our ranking. We gave everyone a grade of either green, yellow, or red, solid, borderline, or danger. And only one member of Wisconsin's delegation fell into either the yellow or the red levels. Senator Ron Johnson got a borderline grade, a yellow grade, for a Stock Act violation that we discovered one of his staffers had made. Also, too, part of our methodology factored in whether the lawmaker had a qualified blind trust and whether the lawmaker traded individual stocks. Senator Ron Johnson does not have a qualified blind trust. Again, that's very common among members of Congress, and he does choose to trade individual stocks. So our rubric gave him a borderline grade. As a result, all the other members in the Wisconsin delegation, both Republicans and Democrats, got a green solid grade.
Time for one more caller. Rose is with us in Menominee Falls. Rose, hi.
Hi there. I believe that Congress people should not be penalized from participating in our economic system, such as buying and purchasing stocks. I mainly feel that we, as with many other things, we already have enough laws. They just need to be enforced better. And so I do not believe we need any more laws regarding this. We just need better enforcement.
Rose, thanks a lot for the call. And Dave, with the existing law, like the Stock Act in particular, is there any talk of more enforcement, whether by congressional ethics committees or by the Justice Department?
And that argument was made by many of the lawmakers that we talked to, that, hey, we don't need more laws. We don't need to go and create a system where lawmakers are limited in what they can do when it comes to the buying and selling of stocks. And they felt that way even despite the fact that many of the companies that they invest in spend significant amounts of money lobbying Congress and buy for significant government contracts too. But put that aside here for a second. The enforcement mechanisms, at least in our reporting that we found, are very weak. And if it is going to be the case going forward, the lawmakers will be able to continue to trade and buy and sell in individual stocks. The related but separate issue of whether the internal enforcement gets better because it's demonstrably and objectively flawed in what we found, that would need to change too. And there's very little talk, at least at this juncture, of Congress doing anything that would strengthen that aspect of the Stock Act.
Rose, thanks for that call. And Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dave Leventhal is the Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Business Insider. We talked about the financial conflicts of interest facing some members of Congress. We've got a link to Insider's Conflicted Congress Project, by the way. You can find it at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. A chef tells us how to make grains, beans, and other hearty staple foods in our kitchen more fun and delicious. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Winter is a great time for warm, hearty meals. It's Food Friday, and our guest today wants to highlight the versatility of some of the unappreciated staple foods in our kitchens. Turns out there's a lot you can do with different kinds of grains, beans, peas, and lentils. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you cook with a lot of beans and grains? Do you look off the beaten path for something different? What has worked well for you? Do you grow beans to sell to people to consume as opposed to for livestock consumption? I know we do a lot of that here in Wisconsin. Love to hear from you, farmers. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Abra Behrens is a chef and author of the cookbook Grist, a practical guide to cooking grains, beans, seeds, and legumes. She lives next door, by the way, over in Michigan. Abra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my goodness. Thanks for your interest and for inviting me on.
Well, you write that for a while, you were like a lot of us, where you maybe took our grains and beans for granted. What got you excited about them enough to write a book?
Well, so much of my cooking is based around the ingredients and getting excited about them and then wanting to figure out, you know, ways to work it into regular rotation in my kitchen. And I started cooking with more beans and grains when the farmers in my life, both my cousin Matt and also the growers at Grainer Farm where I get to cook, were really focusing on growing more of that. And it was the first time that I cooked black beans from my cousin that I was like, oh, these are very different. they're super fresh and creamy, and the liquid was inky black, and they were just so delicious. And so, yeah, they started showing up more and more in my kitchen, and then wanted to see, you know, what else we could do with it, because they're such an important staple that I feel like get sort of maybe short shrift on the excitement page. And so just thinking about other ways to work them in and get excited about it.
And we get excited about local foods sometimes, but you have the same deal in Michigan we have in Wisconsin. You know, asparagus, great. We got that for a couple weeks. Squash, we got it for a month. But the things we're talking about today, beans and grains and things like that, they keep. How much more fun does that make it, knowing that we could really have pretty good quality stuff anytime we want it?
Well, it made it a really different topic. My first cookbook, Roughage, was all about produce. And so, yeah, you know, we have a limited number of things we can grow up here in the northern Midwest, and we have, you know, really distinct seasons. And for the beans and legumes and grains, it was really kind of thinking about it differently, that it's, they have seasons too, but that's not how we use them in our kitchen. They're like a pantry staple, shelf stable. And so they're really at the ready year round. So it really changed the way that I was thinking about writing these recipes, and, you know, something that you kind of have at your back all the time, that doesn't come and go in quite the same way.
Now, you cover a lot of ground. I mean, the beans and lentils and grains, buckwheat and barley and lots of different things. But there's one basic method to cook all of them that kind of works. Boil them right till they're done and take out the excess water. That's a pretty simple, flexible way to approach these things.
Yeah, you know, it's so much of my food is really trying to, or my writing, I guess, is to bring people through the same process that I went through. And I was working in Chicago and was talking with another friend who was cooking with me. And I was like, oh, what's the ratio for rice again? And she was like, oh, I don't even bother anymore. I just boil it like pasta. And I thought, oh, that's so smart. I can just do that. And then, you know, it kind of extrapolated out from that. And it's a funny thing. These are such humble ingredients, but they really have a lot of mystery around them. You know, what's the exact right cooking ratio, or, you know, cooking times, or all of those different things. And when it occurred to me that you could just boil all of them and that's it. You know, it really was an eye opener. And I think so much of food media sort of pulls authority away from home cooks and into the restaurant kitchens and celebrity chef profiles and things like that. And this was a way to say, like, no, really, all you have to do is heat up some water and boil them. And that gives you a really great start. And then everything else is gravy, and you can make it suit your needs or what you have in your kitchen, so that, you know, if you're like us and you just got 9 inches of snow, you don't have to run to the store to get a particular ingredient, but you can use what you have on hand.
We're talking to Abra Behrens. Her new cookbook is called Grist, a practical guide to cooking grains, beans, seeds, and legumes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite bean you use in your cooking, a favorite grain? Do you have a question about how to cook with the things we're talking about, the seeds, beans, grains, and more? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Abra, in your book, you solved a problem that I encountered 30 years ago. I lived by myself in my 20s for a while. I would cook a big batch of beans and rice, or lentil glop, I called it. If I'm going to cook this stuff, I'm going to cook a lot of it. And then I'd eat it that day and the next day. And you know where I'm going. I'm pretty sick of it a little ways in. You have a much better approach to cooking a lot of that stuff up front. What do you do?
Well, first of all, I want to see the recipe for lentil glop.
It wasn't pretty. I'm not going to lie.
Well, it's funny because, you know, that's how throughout the book, there's a series called, you know, lentils, a week of lentils without boredom, or a week of black beans without boredom. And that all came because my sister made a big recipe of lentil glop, I think. And she was so proud of herself I got this text from her that she was like, I'm set for the week. And then every day you could just see her like spiraling over text message, just being so fatigued of eating the same lentil soup every day. And so it occurred to me that, you know, in restaurant kitchens, and that's, most people refer to that as batch cooking, where you make a large amount and then kind of parse it out throughout the week. And in restaurants, we also practice batch cooking, but it's different in that we're not making an entirely finished item, but instead prepping all of the individual ingredients to, you know, roughly 80% of doneness. And then when an order comes in, we finish it. And so I was thinking about ways that, you know, the sort of restaurant mentality could apply in home kitchens as well. And the idea being that if she had just cooked a pot of lentils and then used those lentils differently throughout the week, with the final day being the glop, then, you know, I think she would have had less fatigue. And so that's the idea, is that, you know, cook off a whole pot's worth of barley, and then here are a bunch of different ways to use it. And that can be everything from, you know, having it be the main feature of your dish on the first night when you're excited about it and you just put the pot on the stove. And then maybe the next day you're just going to crisp them up to make sort of like a crunchy topping to a salad or something like that. So you're getting really different attributes throughout the week.
You've shared some recipes with us. And Grist, you've got a carrot farro stew with a lemon chamomile oil. We've got that up on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, farro, I have bought that optimistically and cooked it, and it was okay. I don't really know what to do with farro. What in a recipe like this are we doing with farro?
So farro is it's in the wheat family. It's one of the earlier kind of biological lines of wheat. And the way that most people use it, I think people can think of it very similarly to barley, in that it has a nice starch content. So it makes these really creamy, kind of hearty, toasty, nutty dishes. But it's not as kind of chewy as a traditional wheat berry would be. And a lot of that has to do with the processing. So, you know, same with barley. If you have, if you've gone through the pearling process, which happens, you know, at the seed cleaners or where they're taking some of that outside bran off, that means that the starch is a lot more accessible. So it's going to cook up very creamy, you know, with kind of a creamy texture. And farro is the same way. So I often use it in something like that stew to kind of thicken the stew, because that starch is going to thicken the cooking liquid with it. Or you can do something like I call it farisotto, where you're basically making like a version of risotto, but instead of using rice, you're using this other starchy grain. And I love that carrot stew because it's so simple. I mean, it's farro and carrots, and you're just cooking them down together. But then most of these ingredients that are covered in Grist are kind of the base notes to a dish. They're really nutty or really rich and satisfying, but often that needs to be balanced with something kind of bright and acidic so that it doesn't just feel like strict comfort food only, but gives it a little bit of zip. And so the lemon chamomile oil is really just that. I mean, it's taking chamomile tea, or if you grow chamomile in your garden, you can use the flowers and the leaves for that. Steeping it in some olive oil with some lemon zest, and it just adds this really lovely, like, floral, lemony kind of pop to a really comforting stew.
We're talking to Abra Behrens, a chef who wrote the cookbook Grist, a practical guide to cooking grains, beans, seeds, and legumes. And you can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite kind of bean, a favorite recipe? Do you prefer them in tacos or stews, or fill in the blank? Do you have questions about how to cook certain types of beans or grains? Do you use buckwheat or barley or that farro in your cooking? I was saying farro. I guess it's farro. 800-642-1234 is the number to call with your own recipes, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now we're picking up our talk with Chef Abra Behrens. Her newest cookbook is called Grist, a practical guide to cooking grains, beans, seeds, and legumes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite kind of beans or grains you like to cook with, a favorite recipe you'd like to tell us about, or maybe something you've had at a restaurant that made you have a new respect for these often humble ingredients? Do you have a question about how to make some of this stuff? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you grow some of these things to sell maybe to a local farmer's market or a restaurant, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's get to another recipe now, Abra, that we've got up on the at WPR.org/Food Friday. Lentils this time, lentil and pecan-filled acorn squash with sage fried brown butter. This sounds really good. Tell us about this one.
Oh, I love that recipe so much because it is really just maximum comfort food. I mean, it's And it's something you can make in advance and either just keep in your fridge for later in the week, or you can freeze it and then pop it into the oven when you need a quick meal. But this is another example of that way of, you know, cooking off a bunch of lentils and then working it into something, you know, further on down the road. So this is sort of a play on a traditional, you know, stuffed pepper, stuffed squash. Roast the acorn squash, scoop out that really creamy sweet flesh, and then blend it with some already cooked lentils, some pecans for crunch, there's some cheddar cheese in there, and then you put it back into the skin of the squash and rebake it. And over the top is a little bit of, you know, again, it's kind of like that lemon chamomile oil, just something that's going to add a little bit of herbaceousness to it. So this is some butter where you fry sage in it, and then the butter browns really nicely, it cooks the sage, and it just adds kind of an extra layer of flavor and brightness to it.
Again, you can find that recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. So we got a caller now at 800-642-1234. Cindy is with us in Menominee. Cindy, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What you want to tell us about, Cindy?
Well, I wanted to tell you that yesterday was National Bean Day in the U.S.
Oh, I did not know that.
You're
a bean fan yourself, Cindy?
I am a bean fan. I grew up on a bean farm. My family's company is Chippewa Valley Bean Company, and we handle dark red, light red, and white kidney beans here in our facility. We're a large exporter. We buy beans from farmers throughout the Midwest, Wisconsin, the Central Sands, and around the Menominee-Eau Claire area. And yesterday we had Secretary of Ag Randy Rumansky visit us celebrate National Bean Day.
All right, you sell the beans, Cindy. Do you eat the beans?
Oh, my gosh, yes. You know, a half a cup of beans a day is really an important factor in diets. You know, beans are also pulses, dry beans, peas, lentils, and chickpeas. And they are extremely healthy for you, great protein levels, alternative to, you know, other types of protein. And they can be added to anything, put in any type of dish that you want. There's a multitude of recipes. Our website's out there if you want to take a look. Wisconsin's been doing some great things, too. In fact, we actually will be celebrating through the school systems the Wisconsin Chili Lunch Program. And we have been providing beans to them over the past number of years. But that's a really important thing, too, as our kids have opportunities to eat beans from Wisconsin in their chili in schools.
Cindy, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Wow, a Wisconsin pro on beans, Abra. She mentioned something we haven't gotten into, and you don't really, you know, hit it too hard, but there's a lot of good healthy stuff amongst the grains and beans we're talking about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the caller talking about the protein level, you know, it's a really healthy protein. It doesn't have any saturated fats along with it. It's a really environmentally friendly protein to be raising. And I think, you know, hats off to everyone who is growing these ingredients for us, because most of these things are not grown in our backyard gardens. And Wisconsin really has so many tremendous growers. I really am a big fan of Meadowlark Farms over in Ridgeway, Wisconsin. Hallie and her husband, John Wepking, are a, you know, farmstead grain and mill, and they're doing beautiful beans and wheats and all sorts of stuff. And it's really incredible to see these things in the Midwest and to be then, you know, shared all over the world.
Cindy, thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Abra Behrens about her new cookbook, Grist, A Practical Guide to Cooking Grains, Beans, Seeds, and Legumes. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Cindy mentioned chili. You have a favorite bean-inclusive chili recipe you'd like to share. 800-642-1234 is the number. Abra, I want to visit a couple of the other ingredients you mentioned in the book. Buckwheat. Now, I've gotten buckwheat flour. I've mixed it in with pancake batter. That's cool. I couldn't pick, you know, buckwheat out of a lineup. Otherwise, what is it? What do we do with it?
Buckwheat, you've hit on probably one of my favorite ingredients in the book. Buckwheat it's a grain, but it's not in the wheat family. It's a misnomer. It's a transliteration of a different name. And it's its own thing. And it used to be a really big part of diversified agriculture because it's quick growing. So you can plant it. I know at our farm, we often have to kind of work it into rotation. if it's a really wet spring and we're going to not have enough time to plant wheat in or rye in the spring, buckwheat will go in. And it's just, it's super good for the fields. It's super good for us. And the thing that I love about it so much is that it is incredibly quick cooking. I always assumed that it would take a really long time to cook because it has sort of a Eastern European kind of salt of the earth kind of reputation, I think, or super healthy, you know, 70s hippie granola kind of connotation to it. And so I fully overcooked my first pot of buckwheat when I was boiling it. It really takes about 10 to 12 minutes boiling and it cooks up super fluffy. I now use it often in place of couscous or, you know, anything like that. And it just, it has a really nice texture and nutty flavor and pairs well with lots of things from our area. This time of year, I really like it with roasted beets and a little bit of dill and sour cream, or it goes really well with any sort of, you know, seared fish that's coming out of Wisconsin lakes, things like that.
You also visited a farmer, I think this is in the Detroit area, growing black-eyed peas. First of all, not really peas, right?
No, they're also a bean. Yeah, so that's the other funny thing about all of these ingredients is that they are so simple, but they also have their old ingredients. And so they have lots of different names, which adds to the confusion. So yeah, black-eyed peas, black-eyed crowder peas, things like that are technically a field pea, which is a form of a bean. And yeah, Jerry Hebron is a grower in Detroit with Oakland Avenue Farm. And what I wanted to do with these interviews with different farmers was to show the diversity of growers in the Midwest or even in the larger grain community. So, you know, my cousin is a black bean farmer on the west side of Michigan and has a very, you know, kind of straight ahead sells on the commodity market. And Jerry in Detroit is also a bean farmer in Michigan, but she grows for her community there as a place to create positions of employment and community development in Detroit. And they have very similar outlooks. They have very similar successes and they have very different successes and very different hurdles. And so it's really fascinating to me to learn more about how these different communities are growing these ingredients for us to eat.
Let's bring on another caller now. Nancy is with us in Holman. Nancy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, Nancy?
Well, recently I've switched to plant-based eating, and one of the things I had never considered before was having beans as a snack at my desk. I'll go to the store and I'll buy just, say, even chickpeas or black beans, and I'll rinse them and I'll put them in little Rubbermaid containers and take them to work, and I'll put on different seasonings like hot sauce or different spices just to do it, and I can pick them one by one, and it's so much healthier than like potato chips or other things I could be eating.
I love it, Nancy. Thanks for that call. I've roasted chickpeas in the oven, but this is just rinsed out of the can and some seasonings on them, Abra.
That sounds so good. Yeah, I thought she was going to say roasting them too, where they get super crunchy like a potato chip. And you can do that with almost all of these ingredients. You know, you can do it with black beans or lentils as well. But yeah, I had never thought of just having it straight away. That sounds great.
And just in our last less than a minute now, Abra, some people are purists. You got to cook those beans from dry. You say, hey, a can is just fine, especially if you're in a hurry.
Yeah, I think anything that gets those ingredients into your meal works. You know, I really loved cooking chickpeas from dried all the way through, which takes several hours, and, you know, meticulously skimming the pot and things like that. And now I can't be bothered. I open a can. And so it's really whatever is going to blow your hair back. If you really enjoy that process of slow cooking them yourself, then you should do that. And if you need dinner to get on the table in 20 minutes, pop that can open, and they're also really good ingredients that way.
Abra, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really a treat to be here.
Abra Behrens is a chef and author of the cookbook Grist, a practical guide to cooking grains, beans, seeds, and legumes. We've got two recipes that she shared with us over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Maybe something you can make this weekend. Lentil and pecan-filled acorn squash with some sage-fried brown butter. Or carrot farro stew with lemon chamomile oil. Again, get those over at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can keep sharing your favorites from these categories, the beans, the lentils, legumes, grains, all this stuff, seeds. We didn't really get into seeds. Tell us about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. What happens when hospitals take their patients to court because of medical debt? Get a couple of insights on what happens when it happens and what some of the outcomes are in the court, and call in with your own questions and maybe your own experiences. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. It's a cold day around Wisconsin, so take care of yourself. But here's a silver lining. More cold means more ice on lakes, and that means the Eagle River Ice Castle is making a comeback. I talked to a local fire chief there back in 2014 about the ice castle on Silver Lake in Eagle River. They make them pretty big, but the conditions have to be just right, including some really thick ice. As reported by WXPR in Rhinelander, the last time the castle went up was 2018. But now this year, they hit the required 12 inches of ice on the lake, so now it's time to do the work. And it turns out you can help. Starting tomorrow, volunteers can help load and unload ice blocks and then assist in the construction of the castle. Check in with the Eagle River Chamber of Commerce if you're available to help. If you do, send us some pictures of the work in progress. Email ideas@wpr.org. Ice castles on the ice. This is Central Time.